Jimmy, Jimmy Crane, Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd. Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Oh,
Jimmy. Hey everybody, this is Jimmy Crane, and you're listening to another episode of Improv Nerd, sponsored by the good people at Pan Theater in Oakland. Now, if you're in the San Francisco Bay Area and you want to get your improv fixin', I want you to check out Pan's Improv Dojo Drop-In Class. It is a fun chance to laugh, to learn, and to play. Also, be sure to check out Pan's quarterly auditions for house teams, Awkward Face and Liquid Mind, and Sunday Brunch. All you need to do is go to pantheater.com for details. Pan Theater has been bringing improv goodness to the San Francisco Bay Area for over a decade. All you need to do is go to pantheater.com for current shows and class schedules. But wait, there's more. Pan Theater offers master-level improv workshops with leading guest instructors like myself, Jimmy Crane, host of the Improv Nerd. Last year, I was there 3 times, and I loved it. I had such a great time. All you need to do for upcoming master-level workshops is go to pantheater.com. Also, check out my award-winning improv classes here in Chicago, The Art of Slow Comedy. I've got a Level 2 Art of Slow Comedy starting Wednesday, February 25th. For more information, just go to my website, jimmycorain.com. That's jimmycorain.com. We have a very special episode of Improv Nerd for you today. Now, you know, usually we bring you some very well-known people in the improv world. Today, we're going to do something slightly different. We are going to highlight someone you might not know very well, but is doing great work. He is bringing improv to Claremont Academy in Worcester, Massachusetts, to a high school with a very diverse population. Our guest today is improviser, teacher, director, Danny Bilal. Danny teaches at Clark College, where he teaches theater. He also is a member of the touring company at Improv Boston, and he heads up the program at Claremont Academy in Worcester, Massachusetts. We talked to Danny about his growing up and how he had some rough teenage years with drugs and getting in trouble, and how he transformed himself. We talked to him about how improv and theater has saved his life in a lot of respects, and we talked to him about the work he does at Claremont Academy. I just want to say the work that he's doing in Claremont is really important work, and it just goes to show that you don't have to be famous in improv to make a difference. Now, I got to witness it firsthand because they asked me to come in and teach a couple classes. I don't know if I've shared this story on the podcast or not, and if I have, please excuse me, but I'm going to do it anyways. So I taught the sophomore class, and it was great, and it was a lot of fun. A couple people had heard the podcast, so I felt like a celebrity. The next class, which followed immediately afterwards, was the freshman class, and it was 18 of the most immature, rowdy kids. And from the get-go, they were bouncing off the walls. It's the next period is lunch, so they're not really listening that much, not really good with the agreement. Towards the end of the class, we're playing freeze tag, and there's this kind of like popular girl with glasses, she's wearing a sweatshirt, and this really awkward kid who reminded me of myself. And, you know, he initiated like, oh, why don't you dance with me? And she goes like, no, like a flat out denial. So I stop it and I say, and this was, you know, when I look back, wasn't the smartest thing to say, but I said, hold it a second. Why didn't you agree with him? And she goes, because he's weird. And I started to feel sad, and I could relate to this kid, and because I was always the weird, awkward kid. And so, I was feeling for the kid. So I said, well, you know what? No one's more weird than me. And that kid, that awkward kid's face lit up. He gave me a high five because no one has ever given him an affirmation. I'm sure of it because no one ever gave me an affirmation that it's okay to be weird. And then I said, you know what? Someone tag her out. And someone tagged her out. And then a guy came in, which you know, and two guys started to dance. And in high school, in a very insecure environment of high school, you know how it is, that was such a brave thing. So the two kids danced for a couple seconds, and then someone yelled freeze and tagged them out again. And sometimes when I teach in high schools or I'm teaching like corporate people that have never been exposed to improv before, and something like this happens where someone offers something wonderful and then someone just denies it, it makes me really appreciate improv, because on stage, we are taught to embrace the weirdness. And if we don't embrace the weirdness, we're the ones that look weird. And maybe that's why I like improv so much, because I'm a big, weird adult. And here it is, the Danny Bilal episode. Enjoy.
Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd, oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd.
So let's talk about you. Okay, growing up, you described yourself as a quiet, a small, goofy kid that got bullied a little when you were growing up. What did they bully you about?
I moved around a lot when I was a kid, so there was a lot of, this is the new kid, it's easy to pick on this kid. I had glasses from a very young age. I also got braces when I got glasses, so that was tough. I got a lot of buck teeth, name calling, stuff like that. And I wasn't athletic at all, so I got a lot of that kind of push from kids.
And how did you deal with that kind of stuff?
I deflected with humor, because I have found humor to be the best form of deflection. If I could make the kids laugh, then I knew I had them on my side. And if I got them laughing, that meant I could get them to be friends at some point.
Now, did you get in a lot of fights growing up?
Yeah, a lot.
Because you're looking at you today, you do not seem like a fighter.
No, I'm not today.
Okay. Okay. But back then?
Yeah, I got into a lot. I mean, a lot of it was pretty one-sided.
Meaning?
I got beat up.
Okay.
But then, you know, I learned, and my dad helped out with that too, but I learned,
how did he help you out?
Oh, because he was a very tough guy. He was a carpenter. Mm-hmm. And so he was all about, you got to defend yourself to some degree.
So would you come home and be like, Dad, and he would say, you...
No, I would come home a little beat up, and he would be like, what happened? And I'd be like, well, the kids. And he'd be like, well, you got to hit him back. So I did. And that helped.
Did it?
No.
Okay.
No, it didn't really
help. Because you hit them, you gave one punch, they were, and they hit you, gave
they
you
were
like 30.
Either bigger than me or there were more of them. Mm-hmm. Then, and so it didn't help the most.
Mm-hmm. And then you have a very interesting story. In ninth grade was not a good time for you.
Ninth grade was a very tough time for me. So my parents got divorced when I was very young. And
like two, right, or something?
I was two. Okay. Yeah, I was 2 years old. And then I was bouncing back and forth between them a lot, and... in ninth grade, I had kind of run in with a bad crowd. I was doing a lot of drugs. I was getting in a lot of fights. And I got expelled from freshman year of high school at Cambridge Religion Latin.
And what did they kick you out for?
I got searched, and I had something that was construed as a weapon. I had used it to make a bong because I was very smart.
A bong for
marijuana.
Marijuana.
Yeah. It's going really well. Yeah, and so they found that it was like a skewer, but that high
a
school...
A skewer for
like chicken.
Okay, great.
But the Ringe had a zero tolerance policy for weapons, so that was it for me.
And a skewer was considered a weapon?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, anything long and metal, that was
okay.
It.
Okay, even if you use it for barbecuing?
That's right.
Still...
Yeah, why are you bringing it to school is their rationale.
All right, so you get kicked out.
I got kicked out.
And then your parents, there's this period in your life where your parents are trying to get you back on track.
Mm-hmm.
And what kind of stuff do they do to get you back on track?
So my mom's a teacher, so I worked with the janitorial staff at her school.
What was that like?
I was working with an older guy, and the first thing he said to me was, oh, you got in trouble, huh? And I said, yeah. And he was like, I hope it wasn't for drugs. And I was like, it was. And then we worked in silence for 2 months because he wouldn't talk to me after that.
Okay.
So that was tough.
How was that?
Bad.
Because I would have just felt worse about myself.
That's what it did. That's exactly what it did. Because I already knew I had messed up. It was. Mm-hmm. I think it's the only time I've ever seen my father angry was when he found out I got kicked out of school.
And what was? Do you remember what he said to you?
He wouldn't talk to me for 2 days.
Your dad's giving you the silent treatment, mm-hmm. and the janitor's.
Yeah,
giving
it's a lot of silence for me. And I also worked at my stepmother's daycare, She still works at a daycare, so I put in some hours there, and I also did Outward Bound in Utah. We did some whitewater rafting, and I also took my first improv class at Improv Boston.
And what was that like? Because you're like a teenager, and everyone's got to be 10 years older than
you. Yeah, it was weird. I definitely felt like I had to prove myself in a lot of ways. It was kind of like elementary school over again. I was trying to get people to laugh, and nothing was working. I did a lot of like references to Wayne's World and stuff like that that people didn't get. And it was definitely me trying to prove myself for kids, and they weren't kids, so they weren't having it.
And what did you like about taking that class at Improv Boston?
I loved it because it was one of the first times I got up on stage and I was crazy. I yelled a lot and I got a round of applause for it. And so it was like this, it was a good turning point for me to be like, oh, I don't have to be super controlled all the time, especially at a time in my life where I felt so out of control. It was a nice place to let go.
Were you an angry kid when you look back at it?
Yeah.
What do you think you were angry about?
I was definitely angry about my parents separating. I was angry at my mom. She was all about rules. And I was angry at my dad for not being... I wish he had been a bigger presence when I was younger. I think he tried as hard as he could. He didn't leave out from me at all, but I wished he was around more when I was younger.
I know for me growing up, we weren't allowed to express emotions. Yeah. That's why I really love improv.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have a similar experience?
It's interesting. Both my parents are hippies, so there was a lot of how do you feel. And I went to a therapist from a very young age about, I think my parents were worried about me, especially starting around 4 or 5. And so I was pretty comfortable talking about emotions, but when it came to talking to my mom especially, but also my dad, I didn't feel comfortable necessarily saying exactly how I felt. So... I felt like I couldn't be honest with them all the time.
What kind of stuff did you keep from them?
Oh, I lied about everything. Definitely like what happened at school, if I got in trouble, if I didn't do my homework, if like a kid was mean to me. I wanted them to think I was living this perfect life.
Did you steal anything when you were a kid?
I did not steal.
Okay.
It was like the one thing that I was like, that's not for me.
But everything else, like drugs and yeah. Getting in fights, yep.
That was all game.
That was all game.
Yeah.
And you said something interesting to me in the car because you've been driving me around about like you were smart about not getting caught or something, and you said that was the worst thing.
Yeah.
Can you explain that a little?
Sure. I think kids are really smart about not getting caught because, when you're doing something wrong, especially in high school, you're like, oh, I'm going to smoke pot or I'm going to get into this fight, but I'm going to make sure nobody knows. And you get really good at lying or bending the truth to make sure that you're good at being bad. I think teenagers nowadays especially are like perfect at it. And for me, I regret that. I wish I had been a terrible liar. I wish I had gotten caught earlier because then it would have kept me from going down that path.
And then you finally get your act together and you go to Brookline High School.
Yeah, my mom taught at Brookline, and so I was able to go to Brookline, their public school. And so I went there, and I didn't really know anybody my first year as a sophomore, and so the first semester was really hard. But then I auditioned for an improv troupe, and I auditioned for a play, and I got into both. And that was like, I felt good.
And then you said something interesting to me also, that improv and theater at that point had saved your life.
Yeah, absolutely. At that point, I was pretty done with, feeling like I was doing everything wrong. I was done with going home and not knowing who anybody at school was. And then it was like, oh, this is something you're great at. I got the lead in the first play I auditioned for. I was doing improv, and we were doing shows every other week, and it just felt good to be alive again, and that was really nice.
And how did it help with you? Because the stuff you do at Claremont Academy is, because I got to teach a class today. It's about really, it's improv, but it's also helping with kids in their self-esteem and stuff like that. How did theater and improv help you with your self-esteem for you?
Yes, so it helped me meet other kids.
Were you kind of socially awkward?
Well, you're coming in sophomore year, and the kids at Brookline were very affluent. I wasn't super affluent.
You were kind of like the poor kid.
Yeah.
Did you have a chip on your shoulder about that?
Absolutely. As soon as I saw like the first 16-year-old I knew drive up in a Benz to high school, I was like, this is no thank you.
Did you like hate the rich kids?
I definitely did not like them at that moment, especially because it took me an hour to get to school on the train, and so I was like, oh, these kids can walk to school, but they're driving. But what theater helped is like it made me see them as human beings instead of these entities for me to hate. It was like, oh, I can do theater and now I know this person and they're not an asshole. They're actually a pretty nice person. And that helped me socially, but it also helped my self-esteem in terms of my grades and also helped me in terms of my interactions with my parents as well.
Now, people say it helps with your self-esteem. What do you think it is about theater and improv that helps with people's self-esteem?
Getting a round of applause for something you've done is, I think, just on a basic level, is approval. And I think I was definitely a kid that was seeking approval from a very young age.
Because you weren't getting it from your house.
Right. Right, and so as soon as, and especially when I got kicked out of high school, there was approval from nowhere.
Like anti-approval.
Anti-approval, it was like, yeah. And so, but there's that visceral reaction. I'm sure you felt it too.
I still have it.
Yeah, and then you're chasing that approval then, because it feels so good to be on stage and to get that validation. But I also think it's something about the process too. You're working really hard on something, and you're not doing it alone. You're doing it with other people. And that, to me, is like, someone saying, what you have to say is worthy. What you have to say is worth it. And so I'm going to listen to you, and we're going to build something together.
And then you end up here at Clark University.
That's right.
Yep. And you're an English major?
Yeah, I'm a theater and English double major.
And you love poetry.
I do.
And you're in poetry for the money, right? Same as improv. A lot of money in poetry.
I think... when I was... I forget how old I was, but I think it was like 18 or 19. I said to my mom, I was like, you know what? I'm never going to be rich, Mom, but I'll always love you. And she tells me that story every day because she's like, well, it's happening. You're making some money now.
You're living your dream.
Yeah. Yeah, but I was doing poetry. I was doing theater. I started here at Clark, and I got onto the Peapod Squad, which is the
And you guys were doing, at that time, short form?
Only short form
games.
And I got into some of the plays here, and I was also doing a show called Articulation, which was back in Boston, but with one other person here at Clark.
And Articulation was poetry and improv?
Yeah, and improv and some theater elements as well.
And then it takes you 5 years to graduate, right?
Yeah, I get a fifth year. So I do my master's degree in 1 year. And along that way, I'm teaching. I had been the TA, or teaching assistant, for Creative Actor, which is the introductory course here. And I had done that sophomore year through senior year. So I developed, I burped.
And we're not going to edit that out.
We're not going to edit that out.
It stays.
Leave the door thing and leave that. Great.
Right.
So I had gotten a taste for teaching, and I had done some teaching even before college. By the time I got to fifth year, I was like, I want to teach. And I didn't know what I wanted to teach necessarily, but it was a free master's degree, so I didn't want to say no to that. And I also had known people that had gone through the program and spoken very highly of it.
And this is what I love about you, is you seem like somebody who is very comfortable being an improv teacher. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, it's always scary, but it's the most comfortable I feel versus doing anything else.
More than being on stage improvising?
Yeah, I'm much more comfortable in a classroom than I am on stage.
The other thing I find interesting is you've got this great day job. Can you tell us a little about this great day job
sure.
that you have?
Yeah, I love my day job. My day job is this, and all the people, or most of the people here, get to
well,
know
this
that.
They're not going to get it
yeah,
on the
yeah,
podcast.
Yeah. I'll talk about it. So the day job is I get to teach Creative Actor, which is the introductory theater course here. I get to teach Teaching Creativity, which is overseeing teachers at Claremont Academy, and teaching theater there. And then I also teach at Improv Boston. So really, all of my work stems from teaching and stems from improv at this point.
And, you know, it's not a huge time commitment, so you have plenty of time to do performing and do stuff at Improv Boston.
That's right.
Let's talk about what you're doing at Claremont Academy versus how do you approach Claremont Academy differently than how you would approach a class at Improv Boston? Mm.
Well, you were there today. What did you notice when you were there today? What did you see in the kids versus when you're teaching adults in improv?
What did I see?
Mm-hmm.
I saw that they're younger, so mm-hmm. you've got to tailor that a little in terms mm-hmm. of language. And they're more at a basic level. So mm-hmm. it's to me, it's more of an introductory course.
Sure, yeah. I handle high school kids differently because it's interesting. They are more and less delicate than adults in certain ways. I think they're more delicate because they can't be pushed as hard on the improv level. Some of them can, actually, but they can be pushed a lot harder in terms of their presence on stage, their comfortability with each other. I find adults, by the time they get to be 20-something, 30-something, there's already this disconnect between them, and at high school, they're much more willing to play with each other, much more willing to be who they actually are. And so the way I tailor it is I have to think about who the kids are, where they're coming from, and what's going to address those things. But also what's going to get the improv out of them, or what's going to get the improv into them.
Now, Claremont Academy is not far from Clark University.
No.
It's a very diverse, mixed school in mm-hmm. terms of... No really theater arts program until a couple years ago.
That's right. There's a teacher named Peter Weiler who teaches there who has done some great work, but he was teaching one course only. And when he brought, when we got brought in last year, we were brought in only twice a week, but this year we're doing freshmen and sophomores 4 days a week.
Why do you think it's important for that school?
I think it's important for every school ever. But I think improv and theater is important, especially in an inner city school, because it, for the same reason it was important for me, it builds self-esteem in the kids. It shows them that it's okay to fail. It builds resilience in them so they can fail and bounce back and get ready to fail again, because that's life. And it shows them that they can succeed in front of their peers in a way that is unexpected. And for them, that's fantastic. Anytime you can do that, it's great.
Now, I asked you about what your philosophy is in teaching, and you told me this. Love the kids, love the material, love yourself. All right, so let's break this down.
All right.
Love the kids.
Yeah, if you don't love the people you're teaching, then you're not really teaching them. I've always believed that. Even the worst kid in class, like the kid that talks the entire time or won't sit up or doesn't want to participate, if you can't find a reason to love that kid, then you can't teach that kid.
What do you do with that kid that's not paying attention or is disruptive? I've had plenty of them.
Of course. I think I have them in college classes.
God bless you.
God bless
you.
Yeah.
I think they're paying all this money and disrupting the class.
That's interesting. It really depends on the kid, and it's on a kid-by-kid basis. A lot of it is I will put those students in leadership positions a lot of the time because that means that they gain ownership about it, and that means that they will actually be put in a confident place because of it. I'll also call them out on their business. A lot of kids push limits, and they're waiting to see, oh, is he going to say something? And it's like, if you don't say something, you're not teaching.
I think it doesn't matter if you're teaching at a very young age, like in high school, or even now people are taking improv in third and fourth grade, or you're teaching adults. I think one of the biggest things is people love to push boundaries.
Yeah. Yeah, and especially in improv, because they're like, as soon as people, human beings hear, you can do anything. Where do we go in our heads? We're like, oh, so we can say swears now. or like, oh, we're going to talk about poop. Can't talk about poop right at the dinner table. And that's just where we as human beings go. And especially in a classroom when you're creating this spontaneous community with the kids, a lot of that comes up and bubbles up. And I think the trick is not stifling that voice while still being able to focus it.
The other one you forgot, I don't care if it's high school kids or I'm teaching in corporate, with doing corporate workshops, improv corporate workshops, sex.
There's every time.
Always sex every time. Is always an undercurrent.
There's always a guy that wants to talk about his penis every single time. It just
and in corporate they think they're really the funniest guy there. Yeah.
That's because they tell those jokes around the water cooler and Jim and Bob laugh at those jokes. So they get that's negative reinforcement.
I think there should be a workshop to get Jim and Bob fired. Love the material.
Love the material. Yeah, you gotta love what you, for the same reason you gotta love the kids. When I was doing fifth year, I had to teach English and I had to teach a lot of stuff for the MCAS towards the test. And I was having a hard time, and I found when I was struggling with the material, I wasn't a good teacher. I think just like you can find even the kids that are a pain in the butt to love, you have to find the stuff that you don't like teaching, and you got to find a reason to love that.
Okay, this one I need help with. Love yourself.
I need a lot of help with. I think we all need help with that. But a big part of it is kids, especially high school kids, they can smell BS a mile away. And when I'm not confident, when I'm uncomfortable with myself, I'm actually acting as their model of behavior in theater because I'm the deal. This goes for college, this goes for high school, this goes for everything. So if I step into a room and I'm uncomfortable, the kids are going to be uncomfortable. Or if I step into a room and I don't love myself, the kids aren't going to necessarily see that. So I work every day on finding reasons. It's the same thing. You find the kid that annoys you. I find the stuff that annoys me about myself, and I find a reason to love it.
This is what I believe in my teaching, and this might get a little psychoanalytic. I don't care.
Good.
What part of your childhood you're trying to get back?
Ooh,
in teaching improv?
I love that.
Because I know for me, it's I didn't get to express myself, and I was neglected as a child.
Sure. I would definitely not say I was neglected. I have one of the best set of parents that I, not to compare my parents, but they're great. So I definitely wasn't neglected. I think I was hungry for means of expression and means of validation through art, and I didn't necessarily have it until I had that improv class in ninth grade. And so I'm trying to recreate the ability to get validated almost immediately for what I who I was.
And how are you trying to teach the students that?
You got to tell them that every choice they make is a right choice on stage. If you're making a choice on stage, then you're doing the right thing. And that is immediate self-validation. And the other thing I try and teach the most is your job is to make the other person on stage look better than you. And that's validating each other automatically.
And what does that really mean when you say that? Because that's that concept, we can throw it around, but how do you put it into action?
In improv, it's if you step out and make a choice, I'm not going to make a contrary choice. I'm not going to ignore that choice. I'm not going to view that choice as annoying. I'm going to take that choice as a gift, and I'm going to build upon it. So if you're coming out and you start making French fries, I'm going to come out and somehow support that. Maybe I'm flipping burgers. Maybe I'm a customer. Maybe I'm your wife who's at home yelling at you from afar to stop making those French fries. Whatever it is, I'm accepting what you're doing and I'm building upon it. And that works emotionally, that works with status, that works with physicality. I think we run a lot into someone makes a choice and I block that choice. An example of that might be you're making French fries and I might come out and say, those aren't French fries. That's not me making you look good in that moment.
All right, now we're going to see if we can make each other look good, because we're going to improvise.
Yay.
Okay. What would you like to take as a suggestion?
I usually take emotions as a suggestion.
Okay, and why do you usually take emotions as a suggestion?
It's a really easy way to start a scene, I find, because a lot of, well, especially what I teach, but a lot of what I do is, okay, what is your character feeling? Is how is your character feeling about the other person?
Great. So could we have an emotion to start with?
Hungry.
Hungry is not an emotion, right?
Jealousy.
Hungry, well, the way I teach it is...
Okay, let's take. So hungry, I, of course, just was like, hungry's not an emotion. I don't want
You're
it.
You're not making that person look good, Jen.
No, I'm not, because I'm in fear. But and I'm controlling. So what... We got hungry. What would you do with that? You would take that, right?
I do. So I do two things. I always take the first suggestion.
Okay, why do you take the first suggestion?
Because we saw it happen just now. Someone says hungry, and if you don't take it, the rest of the crowd picks up on that, and then they say it even more. They find different ways to say it, like hangry or hungry.
So you do it so a riot doesn't break out.
Yeah. Well, okay. I do a lot of late night shows, and you do a late night show, and there's people are drinking in the show, or there's a bachelorette party, and they might say something inappropriate, like dildo factory.
If Love you don't, that suggestion.
It happens.
You can do so much with
so
dildo
much
factory.
With that. But if you don't take that, that person is going to get more and more involved in wanting that suggestion. You're not validating their choice. What you can do is is that emotion? No. But emotional hunger, that's certainly wanting, that's an emotion. So I would take that emotion and I would use it that way. Or I would take it and take anger, because when I'm hungry, I'm usually angry.
Okay, great. So that's how you break it down.
That's how I would break it down.
Okay, I was just like, I just stiff-armed it. I'm like, no, it's not an emotion. All right, so, okay, we're going to do a scene now.
Great.
Then we're calling the scene.
We're calling the scene.
Great. Phil.
Hey.
Hey, look.
Jim,
come on in.
Jim, okay, I'm in. Jim, relax.
Okay.
Relax.
No.
Jim, relax.
I made this cake. I just wanted you to just take a look at it.
It's great.
Jim,
I looked at it. It's great.
No, I really want you to look at it.
Do you want me to look at it again?
Yeah.
Jim, are you okay?
I'm fine.
Okay. You're giving me a lot of... Okay.
Because, it's Ron's birthday, and I just want to make sure.
Hey,
you know?
Ron's going to be very happy. The fact that you just made him a cake that all by itself, you're going to do great.
Really?
Yeah.
Did he say that?
No. No, he didn't physically say that, but I know him. He's going to be okay.
What's he saying about me?
He actually says... You know what, never mind.
No, I want to know.
No, you know what, let's, look at this cake! Look at the cake!
Don't change the subject.
Okay.
What does Ron think of me, really?
He and I we had a beer last night.
You guys went out for a beer?
We go out for a beer.
I've asked him for a beer, like, hey, Ron, let's go out for a beer, but he keeps saying, you know, he's busy, he's got to go home to his wife.
Yeah, he said that. He said that to me, yeah.
Wait, he said that to you?
Yeah, we went out for beer, every Wednesday we go out for...
Every Wednesday you go out?
This cake, oh my God. How did you, the icing, what did you use?
Use chocolate out of the can.
Hey.
Every Wednesday?
Yeah, do you want me to lie to you? Yes, every Wednesday.
Yeah, I didn't want you to lie to me.
Okay, we never had a beer.
No, I didn't want you to lie to me.
Okay.
I just said that as a joke.
Okay. Let's take a breath. Let's both take a breath. I feel like we're... You're not taking a breath. I'm taking a breath.
I'm trying to kill myself.
No, hey, whoa, hey.
I'm trying to suffocate myself.
No, not taking your breath. No, Jim.
If I suffocated myself, what would he say? If you went back right now and said, hey, Ron, Jimmy just killed himself, what would you say?
He would be devastated.
Oh, good, good, good.
No. Don't think like, you shouldn't have to think like that. You made him a cake. That's great.
I want you to tell him that I'm trying to kill myself.
I'm not going
to
tell him that.
I'm going to kill myself.
I'm not going to tell him
I'm going to kill myself with this pen right now. Hey. Don't, you took that pen away from me. You know what I'm going to tell Ron?
What?
You tried to kill me. What would he do then?
Hey, Jim, whoa, hey, whoa, hey.
I see it in your eyes. You're trying to kill
me. I'm not.
Ron!
Hey, Ron, shh. Nothing. Hey, we all need to go. Let's take a breath. No suffocation. I just want us both to take a breath.
Great. Take a breath.
Okay, and do the nose out to the mouth. Real quick.
Done.
No. It's got to be a deep breath.
Deep breath?
Okay.
Does Ron breathe like this?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, Ron breathes like that.
We should all get together and breathe.
Breathe together.
Yeah, we should come together and breathe. We should have a breathing class.
We're going to breathe together.
Like Wednesdays. We should all go out for a beer, and then we should come back to my place. We can sit on my beanbag chairs, and we can breathe together. Why doesn't Ron like me?
What did you put in the cake?
I put chocolate in the cake.
He doesn't like you because he feels like you push him too much.
Is that you saying that?
No,
because
that's
you're
Ron
jealous?
I'm not jealous. What am I jealous of?
My relationship with Ron.
Just because you go golfing with him every Sunday, I'm not jealous of that.
You look jealous. Take a breath.
It's Ron's birthday today. This should be about Ron.
Yeah. Let's not make it about us.
It's not about me. It's not about you.
It's not about us. No.
It's about Ron.
Yeah.
What do you think Ron's thinking about?
He's probably thinking about the cake.
Yeah.
Because I left a little sticky note on his,
oh,
on
to
his
let
chair.
Him know?
And yes. I said, cake, what flavor? ?
I wish I had thought of that. Yeah.
That was 3 weeks ago.
Whoa.
Yeah. Finally.
You got to jump.
Yeah, I went to Human Resources and I said, I want to know what kind of cake Ron wants because he isn't answering the question. You know what they said?
What?
Chocolate.
Do you ever think that we have a problem?
No. No.
I really?
I think you have a problem.
Hey.
Yeah. I think you want Ron's approval and love.
I have Ron's approval and love.
Because you didn't have a father growing up.
Worked. Congratulations.
Well, you're welcome. I'm the kind of guy who would say something that other people in this office don't want to say to your face.
Like what? What else are they saying? What else are they saying behind my back? What
your relationship with Ron? We all know what's going on.
Oh, my relationship with
Ron? Yeah, your relationship with Ron.
What? I'm all ears.
You're a couple?
Whoa. Yes, we are a couple, but that's... How is that everybody's business right now?
It's my business.
Why is it your business?
Because I'm being excluded on Wednesday nights.
Do you want to be part of our couple?
Yeah.
That's not me really asking that question.
Okay.
I'm not really asking that question.
Okay.
Let's take a breath.
Okay.
I feel exactly the same.
I feel great.
Oh, God!
Scene. Great job.
How did I feel about that? I felt okay about it. How did you feel about it?
I felt like at the beginning it started really strong, and then towards the end, I don't know, like I would say the last third, we lost something. What do you think it was?
I think we were trading blows up until that point.
Okay.
Because at the beginning I had a lot of the power, but then we had that nice switch that happened when it showed that I wanted Ron's approval as much, if not more, than you did.
Uh-huh.
But I think we got lost in the stuff towards the end.
Okay. And when you say we got lost in the stuff towards the end, can you be more explicit?
Oh, I have to remember what I just did?
Do you not remember what you do when you get off stage?
Very rarely.
Okay.
When I'm doing it, it's firing really quick.
Uh-huh. Kinda,
especially immediately afterwards, I don't always remember all the choices that were made. That's why I like recording myself.
At
Improv Boston right now, every show is recorded.
And then what do you do with that tape?
I'll watch it with a group or with my director, and we'll break it apart and I'll say, okay, this is this moment, or I'll be able to be like, oh, I don't remember making that choice. I move my head a lot. So I'm able to break down those choices.
Okay. So going back to the scene, can you remember anything? Or
So we were talking about Ron and I as a couple, and then inviting you into the couple, but not really. And then taking a breath, but it not working.
I felt for me, like, towards the end, I was making inventions, you know?
Yeah.
Versus the beginning, we were, like, really committed to the emotion of it.
Yeah.
And I'm just trying to figure out where we went off track.
I think we stopped paying attention to each other. Because at the beginning, it was, you looked nervous, and someone said, you're nervous. And you noticed that about me, and you noticed, and you voiced that about me. I think we were, getting lost in the stuff to me is getting lost in, that's invention town. And that's, I'm not paying attention to you, I'm paying attention to this.
Right.
So don't do that.
Yes. Whatever you do, don't do
what we
I thought the first two-thirds was really strong.
It's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is there anything you would do differently in that scene?
No. Well, maybe a little more object work, but I felt like we had a lot going on there.
Well, what about the last third? Any adjustments you would have made?
I would have listened more to what you were giving me, and I would have tried to ground it in emotion.
Great. So let's pick that up. Okay. So putting down the pen. Right. Okay. So let's play that.
Sure.
Okay. Great. You're trying to kill me.
No, I'm not trying to
trying
kill
to
you.
Kill me.
I'm not trying to kill you.
Oh my God, you're trying to kill me.
Hey, calm down.
You're trying to kill me.
Hey.
You're holding the pen way high.
Okay, I'm sorry.
You're going to come charging at me.
I'm not trying to hold the pen.
Oh my God.
Okay, calm down.
Put it down.
Shh. No. I'm not going to put it down yet.
I don't want,
I want Ron
to hear us.
If I
want Ron to hear us that you're trying to kill me.
Fine. Let him. Ron, no one's dying.
Not yet, Ron. He's going to kill me with the pen.
I'm not going
to. Ow.
No, that's unfair. That's unfair. Okay? If I put the pen down, you might pick it up, and then who knows what's going to happen. I'm going to put it behind my ear. Now, I'm not trying to kill you with it. I'm not trying to wound you. You can't invent an
app. Oh, my God.
Stop.
Oh, my God.
No.
I can't believe you're trying to do this,
Ronnie,
to me.
Ronnie, fine. Okay, Jim.
I'm not falling for this.
Listen.
Look, if I'm going to die, I don't want to be stabbed by a pen.
Look at me. I can't stab it through your
body.
I'm looking at you. I don't have the power to put it through your body. It's not going to happen.
Crap, you don't.
Okay.
Bull crap.
Okay.
Bull crap, you don't.
Okay, here's what's going to happen.
Give me the pen, then.
Okay.
Give me the freaking pen.
Okay, okay.
Give me the pen.
Here's what's going to happen. I'm not going to give you the pen, but here's what's going to happen.
Why aren't you going to give me the pen?
Shh. I'm going to break it apart. Okay?
Then there's going to be ink on. That's a great way to stab even more. You break it apart, you got two things to stab you.
No, break it apart. I'm not going to actually break it. I'm going to unscrew the top. I'm going to do it. Okay.
Oh, unscrew the top, right?
Yeah,
and
I'm going to unscrew the top.
Oh, and then you're going to take that little cap and you're going to spit it out, right?
No,
and then Jim, hit me in the eye.
Jim,
I'll fall on the ground and then you'll stab me. I am not a fool.
Where are
you know what? I am not a fool.
Where are you getting this from? Where are you getting this from?
I am getting this off the internet.
I want you to say that again and listen this time to what you just said.
Look, go ahead. Go ahead, mock me.
Okay. It's not mocking.
I got it off the internet.
That people take pens apart and
Have you seen what's happening in North Korea?
No, they won't.
Do you know
what
the most terrorists that happen in this country?
Pens.
Yes.
Stop it.
That's why
Jim,
they're disposable.
Jim, this,
so they get rid of the evidence.
Your blood pressure is already high.
Oh, you're gonna kill me now.
No,
but
I'm
my
not
blood pressure is high. Oh, that. Oh, you make me so mad.
Okay, I'm gonna
Oh my God, I'm having a heart attack.
I'm putting it down. No, don't have it. Don't do it.
Oh my God, you're gonna kill me.
Ah,
you're killing me.
I put it down. I put it down.
Oh my God, I feel better. See. Okay. Now, all right. Why do you think, why was that better?
It was emotionally higher for you as well as for me, so that automatically was more involved.
Yeah.
Not being able to let go of the pen
uh-huh.
was a nice challenge, I think, for you as well as for me.
Right.
Because we had to figure out, okay, the pen's not going to go down, but neither of us can leave the stage just yet. So we had to be in this confined space, but still have the threat of the pen.
Right. And I always like to play a nut. I love to play a nut. The other thing is...
You
I
do
think,
it well.
Thank you. I do. You should see me in life. Ask my wife. The other thing I liked was, I think it really... Like, it was clear my want was, You know, one of the wants was you were going to kill me.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted the attention of you killing me. So I just held on to that want. And every move you made was still going to, I was going to find some way justify it and make it kill him.
No,
and it was fun.
I
mean, I was having so much more fun the last third than the first time
we
did the scene.
Me too.
So what did we learn from that?
Emotionally, always play it out of 10. Be more invested. Don't give yourself the easy out. I think the easy out for me was, and it stood out to people, putting the pen down immediately. And I think, but we still played off each other. Every move you made was in relation to something I did, and vice versa. I know moving the pen towards you was going to get a reaction,
right,
which is why I did it.
And you could probably even have done that more, don't you think?
Yeah. Yeah.
You
know? That could have been 5 minutes of me doing this.
Right. Great. So now let's go to, we're going to, if we can turn the house lights up.
I'm going
to
do it.
Tyler, are you over there? Can you turn the house lights?
I'm going to do it.
You're
going to
do it? Great. A guest has never turned on the house lights.
It's the space.
It's the space.
Yeah.
I appreciate it. You're a great host.
Thank you.
So we've got questions about what we either done or something for Danny. So who's got a question?
Ooh, nobody.
Really? No one's got a question?
Bunch of dummies.
Great. Right over here.
How do you feel when you teach us in school? Like, how you're always telling us to like teach out of 10 and how people don't when you do it. How do you feel about that?
How
so,
do I?
So the question is, and this is someone who you teach at Claremont,
that's
right?
Correct.
Academy.
Yeah.
What is your name?
Francesca.
Francesca, and she's asking you, the question was, how do you feel about people doing their emotions?
I understand that for a lot of people, it's hard to play out of 10. You just saw me that it's hard to play out of 10, right? And we got that do-over, which you don't get in many scenes. So I understand, because I've been there. I have a lot of shows, and I don't play out of 10 a lot. So I'm very understanding of them not playing out of 10. My goal is to create a space where they feel safe to go out of 10.
So if you looked at our scene, why did we resist playing a 10?
I was nervous.
Mm-hmm.
I was definitely thinking about what I could do that would have been better. Or I felt like the scene wasn't going well, and instead of taking that and going to a 10, I let myself kind of get involved in the stuff.
And what do you feel like, you've got your students here, you didn't, you know, and I get this all the time, we're not perfect.
Yeah.
You didn't do what you taught them.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
I hope it makes me look more human, and it makes me, instead of being, you know, this improv god, it's like I deal with the same stuff that you guys deal with. And that's why I encourage people to see shows that I'm in, because it's like I'm not this great performer. It's like I teach you what I wish I had been taught when I was your age.
Yeah, that's always the hardest thing when people come to my show, and then the next day they'll come to class and they'll say, you didn't do what I told you to do.
Yep.
But it does. It makes you more compassionate. I think it makes you a better teacher. Another question. Right back here.
Hi.
Your name is?
My name's Holden Beale.
How are you?
How old am I?
No
how are you?
Also, how old are you?
I'm very happy to be here.
How old are you?
I'm 37.
Great.
Lots of lies. That's okay.
I'm sure you're familiar with the stereotype of the archetype of the tortured artist.
Sure.
How much do you think having emotional turmoil in the life of an artist is relevant to them producing great work?
To be a tortured artist, how important it is to do good work? Do you need to be a tortured artist?
I don't think so. I know a lot of happy people that had happy childhoods that are very good artists, but I also, knowing human beings, we all have something in our life that tortures us. Whether it's our past or ourselves or a thing in our life, I think there's always something that we as human beings latch onto that's like, this bothers me a lot. And I think that's where a lot of art comes from. A lot of the happy people I know, instead of being tortured, they concern themselves with the people around them and injustices that they see outside of themselves. So I don't think you need to be tortured, but the world's a pretty scary place from time to time, so there's a lot to react to.
Great. Another question?
Great question.
Right here.
So
your name is?
Oh, Gabby.
Gabby! How are you, Gabby?
I'm doing well.
Great. Sorry, I'm sorry I'm so positive.
No,
apologize.
I enjoy
it's refreshing.
So when you are in an improv show, and you know, we just saw you do improv there, and you do a scene, and we were talking about, you know, this laughter that you create and this affirmation that feels really good and makes you feel good about yourself. how do you stay in a show when you had just had a scene? I mean, I struggle with this all the time. You just had a scene that just was not
bombed.
Yeah.
So how do you do it? You're on stage. Gabby's got a great question. Mm-hmm. You bomb.
Yep.
Okay, how do you stay present on stage and not want to go underneath the stage, underneath the trap door in the stage,
sure,
and hide?
I think it depends. If that happens at the end of the show, it can be really difficult because that's the last taste that you're leaving the audience with, right? But what I always tell myself is that was one show, and the cool thing about improv is it's the first and last time that will ever be performed. So maybe I didn't do so well. Uh-oh. Knowing myself, I'll probably beat myself up about that, but then I also know I'm going to have more shows, and that show doesn't define me just like the next show won't define me. I define the shows I'm in.
Do you beat yourself up after a show?
Every show.
And what goes on in your head?
This especially happens when I have good shows, because I'm hearing from everybody and I'm hearing from the other players, oh, good job, good job, good job. In the back of my head, I'm like, I could have held that pen better.
So you won't take in the compliment.
What I do is I listen and I nod and I accept. But
you're not believing it.
There's always that voice in the back of my head, and I think that voice is terrible, but it also makes you better to a certain degree. I think if you listen to that voice too much, it's a problem. But if you listen to that voice enough to say, oh, okay, I need to work on object work a little bit more. Great, I need to work on object. The other thing that I do is if I fail in a scene but it's mid-show, I need to check myself to be like, boy, when I freak out, I do funny voices that don't make any sense because it's my bag of tricks. It's the thing I keep coming back to, and I make sure I don't do that necessarily. We all have things that we come back to when we're not getting the response we want, and you need to trust yourself that just because that scene didn't work, the next scene will.
Great. Another question? Right here?
Tons of them.
Yeah, your name is?
Alex.
You
mentioned recording yourself on video. Like, what are some other ways that you record your progress? It's how you can mark your progress as a performer.
So Alex wants to know, like, how do you mark your progress besides watching it on tape?
Mm. There are very trusted people I have in my life, both for performance and outside of performance. They're either the person I'm dating or...
that being Molly.
Molly.
Okay, great. Just clear for the podcast.
Or it could be other directors, the head of the theater, or friends who I trust. And I always check in with them when they come to see a show. What did you really think? What did you think was going on? What did you see? How is it different from a show that you saw before? And I'm very lucky that I have very honest people in my life who give me feedback. And sometimes when I have a bad show, they're like, yeah, you guys have been better. And I'm very lucky for that.
Great. Another question? Right here.
I'm Rachel.
Hi, Rachel.
Hello. Yeah, hi. So, since improv is so spur of the moment, are there ways that you kind of practice before a show or do any kind of exercises?
How do you practice before a show?
That's my mom's favorite question. It's like, it's improv. What are you doing at rehearsal? And I say, Mom. We practice how to be quick... My uncle put it well once. He was like, oh, you guys are practicing how to be quick with each other. And really what it is you're building trust, you're building comfort both in yourself but also in the people you work with. There's a ton of things to practice in improv. There's emotion to work on and status and object work. But the cool thing is, and it's kind of like improvised jazz, like you learn all the scales, you learn everything led up to it, and then as soon as you step out, you don't know what's going to happen, but you have all that history to kind of draw from.
Great. Another question? Right here.
I'm Margaret.
Hi, Margaret. And Margaret is knitting for the people who are watching. People on the podcast don't know.
Okay.
How close are you to finishing?
Not very close.
Were you knitting throughout the whole show?
No, that would have been rude.
Okay.
Thank you, Margaret.
Is there etiquette with knitting?
Well, it depends on how loud your needles are. Sometimes I have needles that really click a lot.
Great, Molly, second
set. Sometimes you're pulling your needles, and it doesn't matter as much. So if you're kind of sitting in the back, and you're, like, keeping it in your lap, and you don't have to look down a lot, like, sock would be, depending on where you are in the sock, like,
Jimmy,
okay,
this will be the
too,
whole
way
thing.
Too much. Let's
yeah,
get to your question.
This will be the whole
I'll
thing.
Talk, yeah. This isn't knitting nerd, it's improv nerd.
Yeah.
But thank you, Molly.
My question is there anything about theater-making spaces or interactions that makes you uncomfortable, and how do you deal with that?
The uncomfortability at theater and improv. Is there anything? Are you thinking on stage or off stage?
Both. I've worked with you in a bunch of different contexts.
Sure.
Even when you seem to get like fazed by things, it like it always seems to kind of just roll off.
Is there something like, specific that you witnessed that you thought?
No.
Okay.
I'm just curious.
So the personalities as well?
Yeah, like people or like situations. Is there any type of humor that makes you really uncomfortable?
What makes you uncomfortable in theater and improv?
When I was a kid, my dad said, you know you found the job that you want to work if you hate even the terrible parts, and that's what teaching theater is for me. So like even the worst parts of either personalities or dealing with a show that just won't get up or doing an improv scene that isn't going right, I still always find, it's like you always find things to love in the kids that are pains in the butt. I always find reason to love it. I'm getting to do exactly what I want to do 100% of the time right now, so why would I complain about any part of it? And it took me a long time to realize that.
Great. Another question? Right back here.
Are there any specific ways that you like to like change emotions so it's not like so apparent?
What do you mean?
Like say if you want to go from one emotion to the other, is there any ways that you like to like change so you know it doesn't like seem so like cut off?
How do you change emotions? So you go from this scene where it's tell us a little about your process in this scene and how you switch emotions.
Right. So you always want to find a reason in your partner to do that, right? So like at the beginning, I felt like I was way superior to Jimmy's character. And I was like, but then as soon as he started talking about his relationship with Ron, I reacted to that. Or as soon as he started getting freaked out about the pen, I got more intent with it. So if you, because you should change emotions in a scene, I think it's a great thing to do because you can feel like you're stuck in a rut. But you always need to find the reason in your partner. It's got to be a reaction from them.
Great. Another question? Right here?
So another thing you taught me, Danny, was about status. And I know a lot of people come with like inherently high status, low status, whatever. But what is the easiest like and quickest tip to, in a scene, changing your inherent status?
Changing status. What's the quickest way to do that?
Yeah, because something I've taught before is notice what your own status is and then do something different on stage. Physically, if you hold your head straight and you stand up, you hold your head as still as possible, you roll your shoulders back and you stand up straight, you automatically gain status. I'm sure you agree, Jimmy. If you still yourself and you become unfazed by what your partner's doing physically, that increases your status 100-fold. And the opposite is true if you're inherently high status. If you curl up and you move your head a lot, you find a reason to touch your face. I find physicality to be the most telling for status.
Great. Another question?
I guess we got last one.
Sure.
Or second to last one.
Okay.
Going off of that, what's one of the status? Wait, what do you focus on? Do you focus on high status more or low status? What do you feel like is like your thing when it comes to that? And how do you kind of change that up?
Well, how do you change your? Are you a low status guy, high status guy? How do you make those choices?
My bag of tricks is I'll step out on stage and I'll put my chest forward and I'll say, "Oh, what a beautiful morning." That's like a stock character that I've done since I was 16 years old.
Does that character still work?
From time to time, yeah, and I will pull him out in shows still. But it's so that's my inherent thing, and I get a lot of that from teaching too. That is just it's easy for me to get in that mode. But it's interesting because I actually, when I'm hanging out with a group of friends, I view myself as low status. I am quieter, I listen more, definitely defer to other people. But my go-to is that high status guy. Because I don't know if you can speak to this, but it's like I feel more comfortable on stage when I have high status. When I'm low status on stage, I feel a lot more vulnerable.
My biggest thing is I will always go to low status.
Oh,
that's where I'm most comfortable. And that's where I'm most comfortable in life. So I have to work on the high status in my life so it bleeds onto the stage. I'm hoping that works. We have one last question for you.
Sure.
What piece of advice would you give somebody starting out in improv today?
It doesn't matter what other people think about you. It matters how you view yourself and that you are constantly trying to get better for your own measurements, not for anyone else's.
Danny, thank you so much for being our guest.
Thank
you, guys.
I want to thank our guest, Danny Bilal, and the theater department at Clark College in Worcester, Massachusetts, for hosting the show. I also want to thank Dan Schiffmacher. He's the producer here in Chicago who makes the show sound so slick and so professional. You would not be hearing my voice without Dan. Also, if you want more information about me, Jimmy Corrane, and my award-winning classes, The Art of Slow Comedy, and my improv blog, sign up for the newsletter. Every week, I will send you a blog about improv that will make you a better improviser and a better person. Well, the person part is up to you. Also, you know we are on social media. We are on Facebook. So go to Improv Nerd and like us. It really helps with my low self-esteem. Also, follow us on improv_nerd. We are on Twitter, and we have a wonderful YouTube channel, so check that out. You can see actual videos from our live shows. We are also part of a wonderful podcast collective called Feral Audio, so check out all the great, unique, innovative, and hilarious podcasts on feralaudio.com. I want to thank our sponsor again, Pan Theater in Oakland. That's pantheater.com. And I want to thank you for listening. And until next time, remember, walk, don't run.
Hello, I'm Kyle Ayers. I'm the host of Never Seen It, the podcast where comedians rewrite famous movies and TV shows they've never seen, and then we give them a read in studio. This is a clip I want to play for you guys from an episode where Langston Kerman rewrites Scarface. He's never seen it, but he wrote a script based on what he thinks he knows about it, and here's a clip. Give it a listen.
All right, Scarface, The New Frontier. Interior, happening discotheque. Remember when we called clubs discotheques? LOL, the 70s were crazy. Night. The crowd bustles with young, hot Mexicans who are supposed to be Cuban and all are dressed in butterfly collared shirts and pants that look like JNCO jeans and pleated khakis had a really weird baby. There's sex in the air and Poppy wants a whiff.
Oh my God.
Scarface, 22 to 45.
Like he's a television audience demographic.
Devilishly handsome. Not even a little bit Italian looking, so get that out of your dumb brain. Walks through the crowd with the confidence of a man who's going on MTV Cribs with the Ying Yang Twins. One day. Does he actually have a scar on his face? Fuck no. Why would you even ask that? That's not important. What's important is that he is not at all a problematic stereotype and that he has come for his cocaine. As he approaches the red rope of the VIP, pronounced ve a pe in Spanish,
oh my God.
He spots his dear friend who is almost certainly going to become his enemy by the end of the film, Smooth Skin. Scarface yells out his signature line.
Ciao, Bella. It's me, Scarface.
Oh my God.